I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Just ahead, everybody dreads a layoff. But what do you do to survive it? We'll ask two people who've written a lot about it and a person who's living through it in just a few minutes. But first, presumptive presidential nominees Barack Obama and John McCain hunted for votes this week at the annual conferences of two of the country's largest civil rights organizations, the NAACP and the National Council of Raza. Joining us to talk about how the candidates were received is Janet Murguia, president of the National Council. Welcome. Thank you for talking to us.
Sure, Michelle. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Just wrapping up this convention, and obviously you've been talking a lot this week, your organization's now in its 40th year. What do you think is the most important priority today versus when the organization was started?
Well, it's interesting. You know, when we started, we wanted to lift folks out of poverty. It was really around the time of the war on poverty, and people were hoping to create better opportunities for our community. Now, today, when you look at the economy and what's happening right now, it's important for us to think about those folks who may still be invisible out there who need better opportunities to have access in this country.
Well, clearly, you're not invisible to these candidates. Both candidates also spoke at the LULAC conference last week, the League of United Latin American Citizens. Both Senators Obama and McCain spoke there and then came to your conference as well. How do you see this? How do you see the aggressive effort they're making?
Well, I do feel that, the presidential candidates are looking to win the Hispanic vote, and they're coming to our conferences to find it. I think it's fair to say the Latino community is projecting its demographics into political strength by engaging in the voting process.
Of the people attending your conference, what do you think was most important to them to hear from these candidates? And did the candidates speak to their priorities?
I think both received high marks for coming because showing up is important, and that's a big difference from a long time ago. But I also think, you know, what they have to say is something that we are very interested in. And both, I think, talked about their vision for the future, their priorities in the next administration, and understand that the Hispanic community cares about not just one issue like immigration, but, you know, all the issues that are important to their families, like education and health and dealing with the economy and these high gas prices. And I think both candidates talked about that, but I think we're still going to need to hear some more specifics. They're going to have to start drilling down further on exactly how they will carry these priorities through.
I do want to spend a minute on immigration because both candidates did spend some time talking about this issue. Barack Obama came in first. He spoke at the conference on Sunday, and he criticized his opponent, John McCain, for what he called abandoning his earlier stance on immigration. Here's a little bit about what he said.
I don't know about you, but I think it's time for a president who won't walk away from something as important as comprehensive reform just because it becomes politically unpopular. That's the commitment I'm making to you. I marched with you in the streets of Chicago. I fought for you in the Senate. And I will make it a top priority in my first year as president of the United States of America.
You think that's fair? Do you think that John McCain walked away from his earlier position on immigration reform?
Well, what we heard from John McCain was that he's absolutely committed to seeing comprehensive immigration reform happen in his administration, early in his administration. But when you look at how he breaks it down, there is some, I think, concern among some in the Hispanic community, because is John McCain talking about entirely securing the border first and then doing a comprehensive immigration reform, or is he talking about doing that within the context of a comprehensive immigration reform system? And it seems like there's still some confusion around that.
But is this a difference of tone or of substance? Because Barack Obama also said that while we work to strengthen our borders, we need a practical solution for the problem of 12 million people who are here without documentation, and going on to talk about the need for a path for citizenship. Is this really a difference in substance, or is this a difference in tone and emphasis?
Well, I think both, in terms of their tone, have said that this is a priority. And I do believe when Senator Barack Obama talks about understanding this issue, having worked in Latino communities, having marched with many, and having voted on this in the Senate, you know, he has a compelling sense of what this means for the Latino community. He understands this. I think Senator McCain showed great courage in standing up to his party early on this. The question is will he be able to deliver his party once he's president?
One more question on this. Senator McCain also talked about immigration reform and acknowledged that the country hasn't been able to move forward on immigration reform. And he talked about, I think he kind of presented it as a sign of his courage, that he was willing to buck people in his party. He also talked about the tone of the debate. And here's a little bit about what he said.
I know many of you are Democrats, regrettably. I know I must work hard to win your votes. But you've always given me a respectful hearing. I know many of you were disappointed and hurt by those who used the debate on immigration last year. Not to respectfully debate the issue as most did, but to denigrate the contributions of Hispanics to our great country. I denounced those insults then, and I denounce them today.
Do you think that that matters?
It matters greatly to the Latino community, because I think there's no question that the Republican brand has been tarnished by the extreme rhetoric that has come out of the failed immigration reform debate. And for our community, we have seen that while some may say that they're not talking about Hispanics or Latinos, they're only talking about what they call those illegal immigrants. For our community, we know that this is very personal and that people can't tell the difference. And so we're being painted with a broad brush of, I think, negative sentiment. And that, in many respects, is what is mobilizing the Latino vote in this year's election. So Senator McCain struck a real chord when he talked about that issue.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Janet Murguia, president of the National Council of La Raza, which held its annual conference this week. I want to mention something that Senator Obama talked about at the NAACP convention, which is also going on this week in Cincinnati. He talked about this issue of personal responsibility, and I know you know that there was some buzz about some off-color, off-mic comments that Reverend Jesse Jackson made about Senator Obama. He was critical of Senator Obama's kind of emphasis on personal responsibility. Here's what Senator Obama has said, perhaps in response to that, but it's also a theme he's talked about all along. Here it is.
I know there's some who've been saying I've been too tough talking about responsibility. NAACP, I'm here to report. I'm not going to stop talking about it. Because as much as I'm out there fighting to make sure government's doing its job, none of it will make a difference, at least not enough of a difference, if we also, at the same time, don't seize more responsibility in our own lives.
Now, some have criticized this, not as bluntly or as crudely as Reverend Jackson did in these remarks, which were not meant to be public, but that suggesting that Senator Obama's emphasis on personal responsibility detracts from the focus on what other players need to be doing, what government needs to be doing, what business needs to be doing. As a civil rights leader yourself, how do you read these comments?
I agree fully with Senator Obama's message on this point. There's no question that personal responsibility is a priority for the Latino community as well, and something that we see and embrace. But I think we just need to understand that some folks, despite their tireless efforts to try to help themselves, still find some obstacles along the way and some barriers along the way. And we need to be mindful that not just government, but every other sectors can play a role in helping to remove those obstacles.
One of the issues that's come up in connection with this story around these remarks about personal responsibility is the sense that there might be some of a gap between the vision of the people who have been longstanding leaders in the civil rights community and those who are emerging leaders. Do you see that in the Latino community? Is that a conversation that's going on about whether there might be some things from the past that we need to leave behind, whether it's time for new approaches?
You know, I think you always hear about the new guard and the old guard and the different, philosophies that may be attributed to that. All I can do is say that from my experience and my generation, we see the future as one that has, of course, challenges. But I think we try to focus on the opportunities and what we can do to move ourselves and our communities forward. Having said that, I will tell you that with this environment that we have seen as a result of the immigration debate for the Latino community, I feel like we have regressed in some respects, and we've had to really embrace our civil rights roots at this time in the 21st century, and that's regrettable. But we'll always be cognizant of our need to defend the community against injustice and discrimination. But I hope that our focus in this 21st century can be much more opportunity-oriented and really about opening the doors to the American dream and finding the ways that we can do that.
Well, in fact, that leads me to my last question, which is, on the one hand, you've had a year, I mean, you've been president of the National Council since 2005. In the last couple of years, on the one hand, you've seen, as John McCain talked about, a sense that in some ways the Latino community is under attack, at least painted with a sort of a broad and negative brush as part of policy disputes. On the other hand, you have these two candidates competing very hard for your votes. So how do you assess it when you look at the road ahead? Is this a good news story? Is it a bad news story? Is it the best of times, worst of times?
Oh, I think it's both. It's the best of times and the worst of times in some respects for the Latino community. It's a really threshold moment that's filled with choices about how we deal with challenges, but also the knowledge that there are opportunities. I hope for the Latino community, when we finally realize that we can be empowered to move forward and we have to engage in the democratic electoral process to do that.
Janet Murguia is president of the National Council of La Raza. She joined us in San Diego, where the group just wrapped up its annual conference. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. It's a pleasure.
Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, he was the first Asian American to lead a large city and later serve in a presidential cabinet, and he's with us to share some wisdom, former Transportation Secretary Norman Mandetta. But first, you've heard the grim economic news. Mortgage giants Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are in trouble. Retailers are struggling. Automaker General Motors is slashing pay, benefits, and jobs. All of this is resulting in the word nobody wants to hear. Layoffs. Here's Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke on Capitol Hill yesterday.
The economy continues to face numerous difficulties, including ongoing strains in financial markets, declining house prices, a softening labor market, and rising prices of oil, food, and some other commodities.
So we've brought together a special panel to talk about how to pull through a layoff emotionally, financially, and professionally. With us are Beverly Goodman, senior editor of Smart Money Magazine, Sonia Aline, careers and lifestyle editor at Black Enterprise Magazine, and Kathy Henry, a former administrative assistant who was laid off from Ketchum Directory Advertising in August. Welcome to you all. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be here.
Beverly, if I could start with you, the headlines are all about the housing slump, car sales way off. And obviously the thing about layoffs is that they always feel sudden. But are there certain industries or jobs in which you really should be planning for the worst, even if it hasn't happened yet or might never happen, even if nobody said anything to you?
There absolutely are. As Ben Bernanke just said, construction and manufacturing have been particularly hard hit. The little bit of silver lining there is that healthcare and mining have actually added jobs in the past month, so the news is a bit better there. But if you're in an industry that's at all dependent on other industries, like advertising, as Kathy learned, it's particularly difficult because in this sort of economic climate, there's a really big chain reaction that can happen throughout sectors. And if you think that there's basically any chance that your company will be particularly hard hit or your industry will be pretty hard hit, there are definitely steps that you can take.
How would you know? Are there any signs you should be looking for?
Well, again, if your firm's revenue is based solely on selling something, for instance, whether it's advertising or a product like retail, it's obviously dependent on people being able to buy it. And with higher unemployment rates, people, individuals, are not spending as much. Corporations are also not spending as much. Corporate profits have been hit pretty hard, and big business aren't upgrading computers, for instance, as frequently as they had been. So that's one major point to keep in mind.
Sonia, what should people be doing to prepare themselves if they're in one of these sectors that Beverly talked about?
Well, the best thing that an employee can do to prepare himself is to honestly really make sure that he's the best at what he does, because the truth of the matter is, and it's a hard truth, that the best people are never without work. And so part of that is based on how you perform your job, but it's also strongly based on what your network is like, what it looks like, and how well you are recognized and known in your company for what you do.
Kathy, would you tell us a little bit about your story? I know you're the single mom of three. You were laid off in August of last year. How did this all come about? Did it come without warning? Was it a big shock?
No, it didn't come without warning. We found out in October of 2006 that it was a possibility that the company might lose the account that I was working out and several others. So I did look for other work during that time. But I also saved my money, so just in case we get laid off, that I would have a backup plan.
What are some of the steps you took to prepare yourself?
I started getting my resume together. You know, I updated it. I learned some more skills. I also went back to school.
Really? To do what?
I went back to school for a master's in early childhood, which I'm still completing right now.
Oh, okay. So, Sonia, what about that? Was that a good strategy on Kathy's part to try to add some additional training even before the layoff?
That was actually an excellent strategy, because a lot of us, unfortunately, don't see it coming. So she noticed some of the signs and decided to upgrade her resume and decided to go back to school and take some additional training. I mean, that's really key in this environment because markets are changing so rapidly. You really have to consistently update your skills. And so that was excellent on her part.
But you know, that's kind of a catch-22 there. When the environment is shaky and people are nervous, the tendency is to want to, I would think on the part of a manager, to want to see who's really giving their all, you know, who's really throwing their body at the job. And then if you're an employee and you're thinking, you know what, I need to prepare myself. Maybe I need to take a class. Maybe I need to be kind of going to sort of more networking events. Do you think that there's sometimes a tension there at the job between the employer who wants to see who's really hustling and an employee who thinks maybe I should kind of cast my sites look elsewhere, maybe put some energy in other places? Do you think that there's ever a collision of interests there?
Well, this is Sonia speaking. I think what's really important for employees to understand is that they are solely responsible for their careers. And so that means figuring out how you're going to balance making sure that you live up to the expectations at work, but also making sure that you are fully developed as a professional. There's a story that I like to retell, which I think is indicative of a lot of places. But a friend of mine worked for a small production house in Washington, D.C., and when they were going through layoffs, they literally sat around the table with names in a hat. And managers would pull out a name, and if there was no one around the table to vouch for that person, then that was the person that was let go. So it didn't matter whether or not that person worked hard or not, or they felt they worked hard. The fact that they weren't known in the organization, or they didn't have a senior level person to say, you know what, that person is really valuable here, it resulted in them being terminated.
I must tell you, that's horrendous. I mean, that's
like
stories just striking, yeah. Like just sending chills down my spines. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Beverly Goodman of Smart Money Magazine, Sonia Aline of Black Enterprise Magazine, and Kathy Henry, who's talking about how to survive a layoff. And we want to hear from you. If you have a story to tell about how to prepare for or survive a layoff, we'd like to know about it. You can call our comment line at 202-842-3522. Again, that's 202-842-3522. Or just hit us on the Tell Me More page at npr.org and blog it out. Beverly, how can you be smart with your money, to use a phrase that I heard recently? After learning that there might be a layoff coming or after being laid off, what's the first and second thing you should do? For example, if there's a severance package, should you use it to pay down bills? Should you put that money aside?
It depends on the individual, but one thing that everybody should be doing now, just given the current economic climate, even if you don't think your job is in jeopardy, you should start getting your financial house in order. You should know exactly how much you owe, whether it's credit card debt, car notes. Obviously, most people have a pretty good handle on their mortgage, although you'd be surprised. You should just get all of that information together and start paying off the most egregious of the debt, which is, for the vast majority of people, credit card debt. You should start building up your savings account. If you don't have one, you need to start one. And if you do have one, it's a good time to add to it. If you think that your job is in jeopardy, and more importantly, if you think that your company itself is in jeopardy, you also want to start thinking about rolling over your 401k into an IRA that you can then manage, get it away from the company, basically, on your separation.
Can you? What you're saying is, because you probably can't take it out until you are separated from the company, and what you're saying is you should be prepared, you should be doing the research to figure out where you want that money to go.
Exactly. Find out, you know, do a little research, see if you want to open an online brokerage account and keep it there, or if you want to roll it all into a single fund company. There are many reasonable options, but you should start thinking about it now before the worst happens, so you're prepared to put your plan into action when and if you do get laid off.
Sonia, what about the emotional aspect of this? You know, getting laid off brings up all kinds of emotions for people. What advice do you have about how you can manage your emotions at a time like that? Because I'm sure for a lot of people, you feel like, you know, you've been singled out. You may feel it's unfair, particularly it's a job that you really enjoyed or loved. There's a feeling of loss, of grief, anger.
Exactly. And I think it's fair to feel all those things. And I think I think it's fair to explore all that stuff with yourself for a day or two. You just really can't languish there. And then I think it's really important to outline maybe some of the things that you felt you did wrong. It's easy to place blame, but it's important that you try and identify where you might have been able to prevent it so that you know or you have a strategy as you start a new position.
You mean to consider why you might have been vulnerable?
Why you might have. I mean, it might have been, I mean, particularly, and you write about this a lot at Black Enterprise, particularly for minorities and for women, we tend to work really hard in our positions, but we really don't manage our network. We really don't develop mentoring relationships. So a lot of times, you know, we feel that we've been working hard, we've been contributing to this organization, and they've just let me go. But it might have been a result of you not having an advocate there for you, or it might have been a result of you not having a strong enough network so that when you saw the signs, there were people that you could reach out to secure something else before the axe dropped. So those are the things you should really be concentrating on while you're out of work and when you start a new position.
Kathy, what about you? It sounds to me as though you kind of had a good frame of mind about it. You kind of saw what was coming, took steps to prepare. But did you still have some of those feelings of anger, fear?
Oh yes. I had a lot of anger because a part of me felt and still feel that my company lost the account due to upper management negligence, and I was just so angry that so many people, including myself, was being laid off. People that have worked there much longer than I have, you know, 16, 17 years, and now they were being let go due to the negligence of someone else, and I still got a little bit of anger issues about that right now.
Yeah, you can see that, where you feel that you're sort of being affected by decisions you had no control over.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You feel totally out of control.
So how did you manage those feelings, particularly given that you're the head of a household and you still got, you know, kids to raise and bills to pay and all that?
I could not let myself fall into a rut because I do have children. I'm a single parent. I'm the primary caretaker. So I cannot fall apart. So I have to keep going and keep positive.
What are some of the, are there resources, family or other things, church, friends, that you, professional network that you relied upon to kind of keep your head straight?
Friends, church, I read a lot. Mm-hmm. I also do some writing, so a lot of short writing short stories, and really bonding with my children. Although I was laid off, this gave me somewhat of an opportunity to bond with my children, and I found out how bright and intelligent and how much they got my back.
No, that's interesting. Sonia, you raised an interesting point about how you're saying that minorities and women sometimes tend to focus so much on the job that they don't focus on the soft skills like the relationship building. Have you written about this, or have you observed whether men and women experience layoff differently?
I think women tend to be, and it sounds like a stereotype, but we do tend to be a little bit more emotional about it. Again, because we work really hard. And because when you work hard, you expect the payoff. I mean, we've always been told if you just do the work, there are rewards for that. And so when you work really hard and you feel you've been doing a good job and the result is a layoff, you feel hurt and you feel angry. And so I think men are just a little bit more practical in terms of they understand the game, and it really is a game. They understand the game a little better. And so I think they tend to put pieces in place more strategically than women tend to do. I think women are learning that more now. But I think if there's a difference, that's it.
Beverly, what do you think about that? What's your take on that?
I definitely think that's true, that men tend to be a bit more strategic in these circumstances. And as we were discussing before, and as Kathy pointed out, it's very important to have a financial plan, both in general before a potential layoff, but also afterwards. And if you are sort of set along those lines, you know exactly what you're going to negotiate in terms of your severance, and you've got your kids taken care of, it's a lot easier to think more about your next job. It kind of gives you a little more space to think about where you want to work, what you want to do, if you want to change careers, if you want to go back to school. And, you know, again, even though women do perform most of the sort of household bill-paying tasks in this country, it's the men that, I hate to say this, but still tend to be a bit more strategically oriented, both on that front and their career front.
That's interesting to me because, honestly, I could argue it the other way, that men often are so invested in their careers that a layoff feels like more of a sort of a personal affront, whereas, mm-hmm. as Kathy pointed out, she's also very invested in her role as the parent, so she also has that for emotional satisfaction. So I don't know. I was just curious what your take on this, Beverly. How can you think strategically though about if it's time to think about changing careers? If you're in a sector which is contracting, you say, you know what, the writing's on the wall. This is never going to be what it used to be, and I should really think about something else. How can you think strategically about something like that, particularly at a time when you also probably have to look for other employment? Any thoughts about that?
Yeah. Again, you need to know exactly what you're sort of capable of from a financial standpoint, what your obligations are to other people you support. And it pays to negotiate the terms of your departure in addition to severance pay, any accrued vacation, sick pay, pension benefits. You also want to ask about job training or perhaps just a stipend for a particular class. A lot of employers will actually either allow people to stay on to help look for work. That way they just have a place to go with a phone and a computer and a printer. Other employers will set you up with a sort of a career center where you can do that kind of thing. And once you have sort of all your ducks in a row in that sense, you can It's tough. It's definitely not easy, but you can sort of approach it on two fronts. You can look for a job in the industry that you've been working in, which is probably the easiest way to go, even if it's contracting. But it also pays, as Sonia pointed out earlier, to give yourself a little space, mm-hmm. and think about what it is you want to do. And there are areas that are hiring. So mm-hmm. if any of that interests you, now's a great time to train for it.
Okay, very good. Kathy, final word from you. How's it going?
It's going fine. I'm still looking for work. I interviewed today, actually.
Oh.
Going back to school next month, you know, to finish my, you know, semester out. You know, the economy is kind of shady at best right now, so I still have some money saved. They just extended unemployment benefits, which I'm very happy about. That's going to help me a great deal.
All right. Well, keep us posted. Fingers crossed.
Yes.
All right. Kathy Henry is an administrative assistant. She's recovering from a layoff, and as you heard, she's doing okay. We're also joined by Beverly Goodman, senior editor of Smart Money Magazine, and Sonia Aline, careers and lifestyle editor at Black Enterprise Magazine. They both joined us from our New York bureau. Kathy Henry was on the phone from Chicago. Ladies, I thank you all so much for your insights.
Thank you.
Bye. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. It's time for our Wisdom Watch, the part of the program where we speak with distinguished elders from a variety of fields, hoping they'll share not just knowledge, but wisdom from years of accomplishment. Today, Norman Mineta. He's been making history his entire career, becoming the first Asian-American to lead a major city, San Jose, California, then again as the first Asian-American appointed to a presidential cabinet position as President Clinton's Secretary of Commerce. He became the only Democrat in President George W. Bush's cabinet when he was named Secretary of Transportation, where he served as the longest-serving leader of that agency. When Secretary Mineta stopped into our offices recently, he talked about a pivotal day in history that shaped the man he would become.
Without a doubt, December 7th, 1941 was a very devastating time period.
That, of course, was the bombing of Pearl Harbor. In the years following the attack, more than 100,000 Japanese nationals and Japanese Americans were forced into internment camps. Norman Mineta was no exception. He shared his memories of that experience.
I was 11 years old. The day we got on the train, I had my baseball glove and baseball bat. And as I got on the train, the MPs confiscated the bat because it could be used as a lethal weapon. So, yes, I can remember getting down to Santa Anita, the racetrack. The Army had commandeered all the racetracks and the county fairgrounds in Washington, Oregon, and California because they had built-in living quarters, namely the horse stables.
I'm thinking about the metaphor of having your baseball bat confiscated. What a metaphor that is. I mean, it's the most American game. And here you're taking this cherished possession with you, your glove and your ball and your bat, and having your bat taken away. And I'm just thinking what that must have been like as an 11-year-old boy. And then what a metaphor that is.
And I had my Cub Scout uniform on.
Do you ever think about what effect that experience may have had on you?
Well, it wasn't so much the impact on me. For me as a kid, oh boy, we're riding a train overnight to Santa Anita, the racetrack. And yet, I remember when we were pulling out of San Jose, I looked across and all these tears were coming down my dad's face. And I've only seen my dad cry three times. Once was on the 7th of December because he couldn't understand why the land of his birth was now attacking the land of his heart. Second time, May 29th, 1942, when we were pulling out of San Jose, starting on our trip to Santa Anita. And then the third time in 1956 when my mother passed away.
Where do you think your passion for public service has come from? Sometimes when people have a negative experience with government, as you did as an 11-year-old with your family being interned, they just don't want anything to do with it. They want to stay as far away from anything having to do with the government or authorities as possible. Where do you think your passion for public service came from?
My father always said that he wanted us to be participating in community activities, whatever our outlet might be, church, YMCA, YWCA. When I went on to the University of California at Berkeley, I continued to participate in student body activities there. And then right after I graduated, came back to San Jose and joined my dad in his insurance business and kept active in the Japanese-American community. So in 1967, I was appointed to the city council. And then in 1971, the mayor, who had been elected in 67, decided not to seek re-election. And by that time, I was vice mayor. So I did run, and I always said that unemployment was so bad at that time that there were, I believe, 13 candidates running for mayor. But I was able to get elected that year and then served until 1974 when I then ran for Congress.
I know you're being very modest, but I still want to know, what do you think has kept you at it all these years? I mean, two cabinet positions, 10 terms in the Congress, and what do you think's kept you at it all these years?
Well, I think over the years, because of my own experience being evacuated and interned for that period of time, no one spoke up on our behalf. And those who did were called JAP lovers. And so it's something that I think really stuck with me. And so my sort of basis for public service was to try to speak out for the underrepresented and to pick up on those issues that weren't being carried by others.
You were able to, as part of your work in Congress, get the Civil Liberties Act of 1988 passed. Did you feel vindicated when that happened?
Well, I think the whole community was vindicated. I think to have your own government think of you as untrustworthy or disloyal, I think the whole Japanese-American population took on the yoke of shame of their own governments thinking of them as unloyal. And I think they really carried that until August 10th, 1988, when President Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. And the law says, and on behalf of the American people, the Congress apologizes. And that whole legislative action came as a result of a commission called the Commission on Wartime Relocation and Internment of Civilians. And they came to the conclusion after studying what prompted this evacuation and internment was historical racial discrimination, weak political leadership, and wartime hysteria.
Did your experience, do you think your experience and that of your family influence the way you think about the way the immigration issue is being debated now?
Oh, there's no question that it has an impact, because when I think of the fact that we're building a fence all along our southern border, I wonder why haven't we done that on the northern border? So it does impact, I think, not only on how we just deal with issues, how we deal with people. I was Secretary of Transportation on that tragic day of September 11th, 2001. And then there was all this hue and cry about, well, we know who did this. We ought to ban Arab Americans and Muslims from flying planes. That's when I came up with this no racial profiling. And then, you know, editorials and everything saying, what's the matter with that dumb Secretary of Transportation? Why is he frisking blue-haired grandmothers and 12-month-old children instead of going after the culprits that we know? But I remember we were having a cabinet meeting with Republican and Democratic leadership of the House and Senate. And towards the end of that meeting, Congressman David Bonier from Michigan said, Mr. President, we have a large Arab American population in Michigan, and they're very concerned about all this rhetoric that's going on in the press. And President Bush said, David, you're absolutely correct. We want to make sure that what happened to Norm in 1942 doesn't happen today. And so that was a very significant statement made at the time.
Did that mean a lot to you that he said that?
Absolutely. And then the following Monday, he then had a large gathering of Arab Americans when he said, we know who the terrorists are. They're not loyal U.S. American citizens who happen to be of Arab ancestry or faithful followers of the Islam faith, and he was very clear about it.
Can we talk about September 11th a little bit more? You were in such a unique position as Secretary of Transportation. Can I ask you where you were on that day and how you found out about the attacks?
Well, I was having breakfast that morning with the Deputy Prime Minister of Belgium, who was also the Minister of Transport for Belgium. And my chief of staff, John Flaherty, came in and said, Secretary, may I see you? So I excused myself, and I went into my office. At the other end of the office is a TV council, obviously the World Trade Center, black smoke pouring out. And I said, what's that? So I went up to the TV, and I was looking at it. Then all of a sudden, this gray object came from the right side of the screen, and then this white, yellow, orange, billowy cloud from the left side of the screen. And I said, holy cow, what was that? So I finally went back into the conference room and I said, I don't know what's going on in New York, but it's something we're going to have to deal with. So by the time I got back into the office, the White House called and said, get over here right away. So I grabbed some papers and manuals and went downstairs, got in the car. We went into the White House on West Executive Drive. And people are running out of the White House. They're running out of the executive office building. And I said to my driver and security guy, I said, hey, is there something wrong with this picture? We're driving in and they're all running away. Anyway, I went in and they said, you've got to be in the PIOC. I said, PEOC, what's the PEOC? And he said, that's the Presidential Emergency Operations Center.
This is a secure room.
So it's a bunker way under the White House, and it's a secure room.
Was that where you made the decision to bring all the planes down?
It was.
What was it like for you to bring all the planes down, all the commercial airliners, and to bring, what is it, hundreds, thousands?
Well, no, at that point, there were 4,638 airplanes in the air. And they brought them all down in 2 hours and 20 minutes, all safely and without incident.
What was it like for you to give that order?
Well, I was on the phone with Monty Belger, the number two at FAA, and I said, Monty, what do you have on radar? He said, well, we have a plane coming in. The transponder's been turned off, so we don't know the identity of the airplane, the speed, the altitude, anything about the airplane except that every sweep of the radar, we know the progress of the dot. And this was the third one. We now had two, New York, and somehow always sort of thought of, if one of something happens, it's an accident. If two of the same thing happens, it's a trend. But if three of the same things happen in a very short period of time, you know it's a plan or an action. And so right after that third plane went into the Pentagon is when I said, Monty, bring all the planes down.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with former Secretary of Transportation and former Secretary of Commerce, Norman Mineta. After all the things that you've done, what are you proudest of?
Oh, that's like asking which of your children do you love the most. You know, it's tough. I'm still partial to when I was mayor.
Really? Mayor of San Jose?
It was 330,000 in population when I started, 580,000 4 years later. And that whole excitement about putting the sewage treatment plant, building the city so that you have parks, playgrounds, libraries, and knowing this was just the start of the Silicon Valley. And so from that perspective, I really enjoyed being mayor. As a member of Congress, the passage of the Civil Liberties Act of 1988, it took us 10 years to get that bill passed. And then my service as Secretary of Transportation, I thoroughly enjoyed. So it's tough for me to be confronted with what's the one thing you're really proud of. And I just always have to blurt out three of those things as tightly as I can.
Is there anything that's eating at you that you wish you had been able to do that you haven't been able to do?
Oh, I suppose the whole issue of the congestion we're facing today and why were we not able to get better prepared to avoid what's happening across the country. Part of that is the whole funding issue. The gasoline tax is not a sustainable revenue source for building the infrastructure. And we've got to find some mechanism to take its place. But I think the whole issue of trying to grow the economy, no matter what you do, it still requires a sound underpinning of a transportation foundation.
You know what I don't understand?
What's that?
Why haven't you written a book? Of all the things that you've done, the thirsts, all the things we've talked about, why haven't you ever written a book?
Part of it, I think, is because I don't want to appear to be patting myself on the back. And
that would make you the only one in Washington.
But, you know, in fact, just last week someone asked me the same thing. And then I said, because I don't want to appear to be patting myself on the back. And they said, Norm, it's not for you. It's for my kids and their kids to be able to read about what you did at a time when it's not like it is today, where there are more opportunities. You were a trailblazer.
So finally, do you have any wisdom that you could share with us today, maybe directed at a younger you, somebody just starting out?
I guess I remember my dad told me, plan your work and work your plan. One of the things I think I've learned in politics is that you work hard at the job you're at. A lot of people in politics will have their objective or their goal somewhere way out in the distant future. And they're wondering, what is it that I have to do today to help me to get to that goal? And the problem is they'll stumble over something right in front of them because they're always looking at the goal way out there. So I've always said to young people, just work hard at the job you're at. And then when you come to the fork in the road, you don't have to follow the advice of that great philosopher, Yogi Berra, who said, when you get to the fork in the road, take it. You can make your own decision as to whether you're going to take the fork to the left, fork to the right, and you're in control of your own life. And that will then open up opportunities as you progress forward and not have to be so programmed that everything's going to lead you to that goal.
Former Secretary of Transportation, the longest-serving Secretary of Transportation in history, former Secretary of Commerce, the former mayor of San Jose, Norman Mineta, was kind enough to join us in our Washington studio. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for coming to talk to us, and do write that book.
Thank you, Michelle. Will you buy it?
I'll pay retail.
Thanks for the invitation to be here.
Remember, with Tell Me More, the conversation never ends. This week at Tell Me More, we've been featuring stories about coping with economic turmoil. Earlier today, we talked about getting through a layoff. Earlier this week, we talked about preparing the kids to cut back. And we want to hear from you. We'd like to know, how are you doing? Have you or a family member lost a home, lost a job? Are you worried about it? Do you own a small business where you are seeing the effects of the turmoil? How are you coping? Do you have any wisdom to share about coping with tough times? To tell us more about what you think and to read what other listeners are saying, go to our blog at npr.org/tellmemore. You can also call our comment line at 202-842-3522. That number again, 202-842-3522.